is attorney Nikechi Taifa, and I am thrilled to host a talk show entitled Human Rights and Justice. Join me every Wednesday, 5 to 6 p.m., starting September, as I feature insightful commentary and stimulating guests discussing domestic and global themes encompassing political, economic, and social rights. Get up and stand up with me, Nikechi Taifa, Wednesdays, 5 p.m., for Human Rights and Justice.
I'm Muiza Muntali, host of Africa Now, and you're tuned to member-supported WPFW Washington.
And welcome to this hour of We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone, right here on your listener-supported WPFW 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org, Pacifica Foundation Radio emanating from Washington, D.C., 50,000 watts strong over 47 years because you, the listener, decide to support your Jazz and Justice radio station. In return, we try to build better community, one broadcast at a time. We're going to take a look at our current political landscape, the national elections, and other matters with our guest, Dr. Clarence Lussain. He is the professor of political science and the director of international affairs program at Howard University. For more than 40 years and in more than 75 countries, he has written about, studied, and been active in national and international human rights, anti-racism politics, diaspora engagements, U.S. foreign policy, democracy building, and various social justice issues. Dr. Lussain is an international expert and observer with the European Commission Against Racism and Intolerance. Among his many books are The Black History of the White House and his latest, $20 and Change, Harriet Tubman versus Andrew Jackson and the Future of American Democracy. And before we get started, Dr. Lussain, first of all, welcome. I want to acknowledge deeply and with the condolences to family and friends, the two stalwart women, Representative Sheila Jackson Lee and Dr. Bernice Johnson Regan. They will be sorely missed. And hopefully, maybe some of the things we would talk about will live up to the legacy, strength, and determination that they left us with. So how are you, sir?
I am well, and thank you very much for mentioning these two stellar fighters for social justice. Dr. Bernice Reagan was a colleague of mine over at American University. So I knew her not only in her profession as a singer and performer and creative artist, but also her scholarship and her role as a professor.
To the pleasure of many, Dr. Reagan really took arts and culture and made the acknowledgement that it's a organizing driving force that empowers Black people and all people. And for that, I'm grateful. Let's be just quite frank. What have you been paying attention to in this political season? What is focusing your interest, sir?
Well, as everybody has been kind of experiencing, there's just been a cascade of game-changing moments. For a lot of the media, they go to the debate. But I would go back a little bit further to actually when Trump was convicted of 34 felony charges. That's just never happened. This is not even looking at his guilt on sexual assault and fraud for his company, but 34 criminal felony convictions for a major party candidate in the process of consolidating even more power within that party. So the Democrats, I thought, had an opening to raise that issue. But for various reasons, Biden never kind of was able to put that up front. And then, of course, the debate came, and that consolidated the view that many people had that Biden was kind of not up to the task. So there was an effort to present that as a one-off. And maybe if that was the case, he would have prevailed, but it wasn't one-off. George Clooney's letter made that clear that he wasn't talking about the debate. He was talking about having been around Biden at a fundraiser. And there were other witnesses that were coming out as well. So that really kind of shocked the nation. But certainly it sent panic through Democratic activists and progressive activists. So following that, then we get the immunity decision from the Supreme Court, which basically said Trump could do whatever the hell he wants. And that then led to the case in Florida being dropped by Trump's personal judge, basically, Lee Cannon. Then Trump gets as an assassination attempt on Trump, which doesn't necessarily change people's views about Trump. If you didn't like Trump on Saturday morning, 24 hours, you probably still didn't like Trump. But it certainly energized the Republican base and led to, you know, all kinds of memes and mythologies that, you know, Trump was saved by divine intervention and all of that.
And let's stop for a moment on that one in particular. Bipartisan repudiation of political violence.
Right.
Yet very little acknowledgement that political violence is very much a part of U.S. American history.
And more directly, the biggest purveyor of political violence in our era has been Donald Trump. So that wasn't lost as well. So then, you know, you get.
And for the record, let's be clear. Both of us would not want anyone killed, whether they're a political candidate or otherwise.
Not at all. And, you know, again, the defeat of MAGA and Trump should be a political defeat. That's just the principle that we all live by. So then you get the selection of J.D. Vance, which is important because I think that if Trump had actually lost the debate and he saw that he really needed to expand his the base of the voters, then more likely picking a woman or picking a person of color might have happened. But once they thought that Biden was going to be the candidate and was going to be diminished and And they were looking at the polls as well, that Democratic voters were moving away from Biden. Then Trump felt, well, I can pick a baby Trump and we can win just by mobilizing the MAGA base. So they picked J.D. Vance. From my vantage point, the Republican convention was actually pretty disastrous. Trump's speech was like one of his worst, and that's a lot.
The New York Times reported this morning more falsehoods in that speech than his 2016 speech.
Yeah, it was just a spigot of lies and misrepresentations and everything. But still, coming out of the convention on Thursday, they still had momentum. The Democratic Party was in upheaval as more and more voices within the Democratic Party, Democratic Party leadership, either explicitly or covertly, were calling for Biden to step away. Meanwhile, you had on the African American side, the Congressional Black Caucus rallying around Biden. There was a letter from 1,400 Black women rallying around the Biden-Harris ticket. So you had some pretty severe dissonance going on. But then all of that gets overthrown by Biden's announcement on Sunday, which is, again, another game changer that completely uproots where the Republican Party thought it was going and where the Democratic Party really needed that decision. And then we saw almost immediately fundraising. We saw rallying around Kamala Harris in ways that we just haven't seen in much of our political life.
Well, let me remark.
Major party politics.
Two days straight of record-breaking fundraising. Not to say that's a merit and virtue in itself, but it's certainly an outstanding barometer in U.S. politics. 44,000 Black women get on a Zoom call to demonstrate support. Then a tidal wave of mainstream Democratic officials beginning to endorse her. Plus, keeping to her word, she went out and did the work with delegates. And now it looks like she has the apparent momentum to be the nominee, of course.
And also the polls are starting to come out. There's a poll just released either yesterday or this morning from Landmark down in Georgia that basically has her tied with Trump. Basically, I had written off Georgia. Georgia looked pretty bad. The polling for the last 6 or 7 months were all going against the Biden-Harris ticket. And it just seemed that even though they won in the last race, that might have been an anomaly. But what the polls are showing, the poll that just came out, is that she has driven, and this is literally in the last couple of days, she's driven the numbers up, principally being driven by Black women in Georgia. And we know the importance of Black women for those two Senate seats back in 2021. And so there has been a real dynamic change since Sunday. And we'll see how this plays out. But there really was a need to find a way to bring together this broad anti-MAGA majority that is clear on stopping Trump, but has not necessarily coalesced because of the many, many different elements of that coalition.
Well, another thing too, Monday night, I had a number of brothers ask me, was I going to be on the call? I was at an event, but I knew the call they were referring to, and that was Black men right, coming out on a Zoom call to just do a public demonstration of support as well. And I think that tickles, if not knocks down, this whole notion that mainstream media emphasize is that there's this sliver or segment of Black men who are inherently misogynist and against Black women politicians. So,
no, this is so important because the Trump campaign has argued that it is making headway into the Black community and is pointing to polls, some polls showing this gender split, and that Black men are open to or saying they're going to support Donald Trump. And that is some really questionable data. And I think the data we're going to start to see is going to really push back against that. We did a poll at Howard University. We have a polling group called the Howard Initiative on Polling. And on Monday and Tuesday, we polled about 900 or so Black registered voters from all over the country. And we'll be putting that report out in the next day or two. But some of the highlights, 96% of the people we polled, Black registered voters, say they're voting for Harris. And, you know, that's reported that they had literally shifted from not planning to vote for Biden. Some actually had planned to vote for Trump, and they have moved into the Harris camp. And so I think we're going to see that, particularly if the Democrats are effective at getting the message out that this election really is about stopping the danger of Trump. If Trump is the focus of the election, they lose. We saw that in 2020. We saw it in 2020. We also saw it in 2022. When Trump was on the ballot or people supporting the Trump supported, they lost. So they have to be really, really effective in getting that message out, as well as what will the Democrats do. What will a Harris administration do when it comes back to power? And I think Biden was also very inadequate, let me say, in that he wasn't until a few weeks ago that he actually began to talk about what he might do in a second term. And they were also very, there were shortcomings in addressing Project 2025, which as many of the listeners know is basically the blueprint for Trump authoritarianism. And Biden did not even speak of that until around the time of the debate. And so, you know, if they can hit...
Are Democrats by and large speaking about Project 2025? I know the House Majority Leader, Mr. Jeffries, mentions it quite often. I'm really in a fog as to whether it's being mentioned a lot by political officials.
More so now. And you know, this thing has been out since last year. I wrote about it, I think, in October or something, and others as well. But the party simply has not, neither from the DNC in the past or from party leaders. But increasingly, that has become part of the talking point because it really does represent a dramatic turn towards autocracy. You know, this is 900 pages of we're going to remake the U.S. government. And so,
however, there are many good groups of civic interest that have done summaries and excerpts of this.
Right.
I don't know what to call it. Manifesto, proposal, what have
you. Right.
Allow me to reintroduce you. We're talking to Dr. Clarence Lussain, professor of political science and the director of the International Affairs Program at Howard University. We're taking a current look at our current political landscape, whether it's the national election or other matters. And you're listening to We the People right here on WPFW 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org. Well, Dr. Lussain, you open a number of questions. Someone has said we're in a period of political excitement. Let me capitalize on that and say, is this a time of reorganization for the Democratic Party as far as you see it? There's been this open acknowledgement of an age problem, not only ascribed to President Biden, but with the passing of many of the Democratic leaders of a long tenure. And I'm impressed, or I shouldn't say impressed, but I observed that the other party seems to have a system where they're deliberately bringing up younger and younger politicians into the fray.
Yeah, so this is, again, a moment where you take advantage of new opportunities opening up. Certainly on the other side, as you mentioned, J.D. Vance is 39. He's barely eligible to even be on the ticket. But that is very deliberate and very conscious. We see that with the appointment of people to the Supreme Court, both from the Democrats and the Republicans, that, you know, you want to basically protect the future. And so now with Biden being off the ticket, the issue of age actually shifts over to the Republican Party and to their main candidate. And
who's just 3 years younger. And if we talk about memory and focus issues, without being a partisan, I don't need to be apologetic in the moment, but there's just plenty of publicly witnessed evidence to make one wonder. And yet mainstream media does not seem to give the same treatment to this individual.
Including Trump's speech at the Republican National Convention. And Applebaum did a really good piece in The Atlantic the other day where she pulled out several passages, and they're just complete gibberish. They make no sense at all. But this is who Trump is and who he's been at least for the last few years. And so more attention kind of focused on that. And then Kamala Harris with her prosecutorial talent should really be able to kind of highlight that in a way that, again, Biden unfortunately could not, and certainly did not in the first debate, where Trump's performance was second only in awfulness to Biden's.
You know, you mentioned Ann Applebaum in this particular comment. She's considered the expert on authoritarianism, or one of many experts on authoritarianism. Her new book's Autocracy Incorporated, The Dictators Who Want to Run the World, for those who want to just follow through and go a little bit deeper. Let's put things in the positive. Is this a breakthrough moment for progressives? Is this a breakthrough moment for social movements? And I'll follow up certainly with several points here.
So, in order for the Democrats to win, they will need a coalition that will include progressives to the left and to whatever degree disaffected Republicans. So progressives have to be very skillful in keeping this coalition, helping it cohere, while at the same time strongly advocating for an agenda for the next administration and if Harris wins, the Harris administration, that would address some of the issues that Biden to some degree looked at, but many were missed, and that Democrats in Congress have not been completely effective at. So, for example, around police reform, around voting rights, around abortion rights, issues around the environment. You know, there's a range of calling that should be high on the agenda and should make themselves apparent in the campaign of Kamala Harris. And so progressives, you know, really have an opening here to push again, because there's this victory of Harris will not be possible without there being very, very strong both grassroots support and organizing support coming from progressives.
By way of her rhetoric, she has said, not to take the wrong implication from your comment, but it doesn't all fall on Vice President Harris. It doesn't all fall on Kamala. It really reflects that organizing and activism, it's a constant way of life for many of us. And you mentioned police reform as an issue, let us be mindful that Devante Mitchell was killed by private security guards outside of a downtown hotel in Milwaukee while the RNC was going on, in many ways similar to George Floyd. And yet there's very little traction on that. And that Sonia Massey in the vicinity of Springfield, Illinois, was brutally shot and killed by a police officer who was reassigned to, I think, six different departments within 4 years, if I've got that right. So the stakes are high. They're quite serious. And we don't need mainstreaming that represents inaction, I would think.
So one issue I would add that the Harris campaign needs to get in front of is immigration. So this is the center of the basically racist diatribe we're seeing from the Republican side, from migrant crime to they're taking jobs. You know, immigration is the linchpin of what they're attempting to argue, in part because they lose on every other single issue. But the Democrats should not run away from this, because the immigration issue actually is one that, beyond needing massive reform, is one in which you can have space for talking about ways in which immigrants have benefited the country, have in the past, and continue to benefit the country today. And that the criticism coming from the Republican side is through and through racism. They're not talking about immigrants from Canada and from the UK and from Sweden. This is very much focused on tapping into this other frame and this replacement theory approach to foreign policy. So the Democrats should not be afraid of that issue and take it away from the Republicans. And then their kind of house of cards really kind of falls apart.
Well, you know, immigration has gone down under the Biden administration by many measures. But here's the thing. There are facts, observations, analysis that we all need to make for ourselves. But when it comes down to it, affect, emotions, and what feelings you leave somebody with seem to be the political currency of the day. And so perhaps, just perhaps, and please do react to this, this faux effectiveness of the racial conjure of immigration and other racial tropes seems to be quite effective overall historically, and therefore you get a third rail syndrome of Democrats not wanting to engage in this, or I'm trying to say this without judgment, their engagement or the talking point or the addressal of the issues quite shallow.
Yeah, for sure. And again, it's not just been the White House, but Democrats in Congress as well. Have basically attempted to avoid it, the issue after their failed effort at coming up with legislation. But the issue is not going away. And again, it becomes the rallying point for much of MAGA. And the attacks on immigrants have accelerated tremendously over the last number of years. So, not only do you need to kind of address that issue and Department of Justice that would put some attention to the attacks on and again, immigrants of color. And but then for, you know, we need to need policy that effectively puts a progressive immigration system in place.
We're at the halfway point in our show, and as a service to listeners, we're duty bound to bring public service announcements. We're talking to Dr. Clarice Lucena about our current political landscape, whether it's the national elections or other matters. And you're listening to We the People right here on WPFW 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org. Please stick with us as we continue our conversation after this short break.
On Wednesday, July 24th at 11 a.m., people are gathering from around the country to surround the U.S. Capitol and demand the arrest of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for war crimes in Gaza. In a new low for Congress, it is inviting Netanyahu, the subject of a warrant request at the International Criminal Court, to speak. This is at the same time that he is committing a genocide. Tens of thousands of Palestinians, overwhelmingly women and children, have been murdered, and schools, hospitals, houses of worship, and residential neighborhoods have been leveled by increased bombardment by Israel, which is also blocking food, water, and medicine in a siege of starvation and death. On July 24th at 11 a.m., the American people will surround the U.S. Capitol and demand the arrest of Netanyahu. More information, including about transportation, is at shutitdownforpalestine.org. That's shutitdown, the number 4, palestine.org.
And welcome back to We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone, right here at WPFW 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org. We're talking about our current political landscape with Dr. Clarence Lussaine, but I will remind you that there are plenty of good programs for you. For instance, at 1 o'clock today on Through the Air broadcast, host Muiza Mutale of Africa Now brings you issues and concerns of African descended people, not only on the continent, but throughout the world. At 2 p.m., Shewanana with host Zen El Amin puts the focus on Middle Eastern concerns and people. At 3 o'clock, Sophie's Parlor, established by the oldest women's collective on public radio, brings you music and culture by women, but for everyone. Those are the exciting, pertinent, substantive things that help you and help us build better communities, one broadcast at a time. And I thank you, the listeners, for being the near entirety of our support. Dr. Lussaine, thank you for being with us. It's always a pleasure. Regular listeners know you come to us periodically to bring your perspectives on what's going on in our world. We've been pursuing a line of really considering that this may be not just merely a transformational moment, but our current affairs might lead to transformational movements. Earlier this week, the Institute for Policy Studies initialized a first annual Henry A. Wallace Symposium. Henry A. Wallace was a vice president under Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and he was a notable progressive. Perhaps we're going to have John Nichols talk about him and how some of the things he did was a challenge to the Democratic Party and to U.S. society as a whole. But my focus and my memory of that event leads me to quickly get to the question. Suma Arias of People's Action and Erica Smiley of Jobs with Justice talked about this theme that I mentioned earlier, that organizing is a constant way of life. You must engage people where they're at and truly listen to them. Even if you don't agree with them, that is part of what's going to bring about the changes that you're making reference to. Again, we've talked about, and granted, you've pushed us beyond convention, how Democrats need to reorganize. But our hope doesn't lie in that party alone. It lies in what's happening on the ground level. How, in the midst of all this kinetic energy, how is it that groups can organize and demand things? You mentioned before the break, too, Gaza. Right. Knowing you as I do, you're probably mindful of the students in Kenya and Bangladesh,
right,
and elsewhere advocating for justice. How can, especially for us here at PFW, how can we maintain a focus on those necessary things?
Well, it means doing a number of things at the same time. I was in France for the election. I was in northern France, up around Strasbourg, which is all sort of progressive territory. And you saw lots of posters and signs for the new Popular Front. And I was in the South, which tends to be very kind of pro-national rally, pro-fascist. And so, you know, I talked to a number of people, particularly people on the left, and they were very clear that they had to always read the moment, and that history is replete with progressive movements that did not see the danger or did not react to the danger of right-wing and fascist movements. And then that required not only continually to build progressive and left movements, but also finding coalitions and playing a critical role in those coalitions. And so, you know, I think that's part of the lesson of where we're at right now, that it's not in many ways about the Democratic Party. It's about the serious threat that's faced by the far right in this country that has moved from the mainstream to the core of one of the major parties. And it's made it clear if it comes to power, you know, what it will do, which will absolutely redound on the progressive community. So we have to be kind of aware of that as well, but continue to build. Whatever happens in the election, there's still going to be a need to fight for social justice, for racial justice, for women's rights, for all the things that we have listed. And especially if the Democrats win, that fight will have to go on and continue to push. You mentioned Gaza. This is an issue that can't be buried. And even with pushing for defeating the MAGA movement, at the same time, Gaza and the horrific onslaught by the Israeli government should be addressed and confronted as well. And candidate Harris is going to be confronted with these issues. So it will, you know, remain to be seen to what degree she moves away from kind of the Biden commitment. I seriously doubt she's going to completely break, but there's space for her to give more attention to the harm that's happening against the Palestinians, the need to really, really kind of push the Israeli government to back down.
I think it comes down to a fundamental belief of integrally standing for what you know is true, integrally standing for the humanity of every human being, indeed.
Indeed.
And but you mentioned a couple of things. You used the example of France, and right away I can imagine many different arguments. One being, well, there's something in the thinking, there's something in the ethos of, you know, I hate left-right things, but I'll say it for now, the French left, that they had the pragmatic and practical gumption to work together. People don't see that here in the U.S., it's not so much an indictment of the different groups, but the groups are certainly functionally disconnected. I don't think that's the right way to put it.
Right. Well, I mean, the other thing about the French left is also it's been mostly disunited. So it's this is like the third time it had to come together to save France from itself in the second round of voting. Because in the first round, it could not muster enough coherence so that there was a clear left candidate that would be in the second round. So there's, you know, again, lessons to learn from that as well. I think here in the U.S., What we saw in the last couple of days is across the spectrum, many of the social change organizations and progressive groups, they've gotten on board. You mentioned the 44,000.
Well, many of the unions, for instance.
We sent it, you know, Black organizations, Asian organizations, Latino organizations, you know, have all kind of rallied. So the ground is there, but it has to be turned into not just an electoral victory over MAGA, but a new era that makes it clear that, you know, there's a progressive agenda. That should be the public policy focus of the next administration, not only at the congressional level, but in the states as well, where there's massive battles going on around these same issues.
You know, I mentioned Ms. Arias of People's Action. Right. They are doing door-to-door dialogues, and they hope to reach, I believe, 590,000 dialogues with people throughout the country, state by state. State organizing in Georgia, since you mentioned the last two election cycles, was critical. Right. We're constantly mentioning Black women in this conversation. They organize. They talk to other people about what the concern is. What's lacking in the moment sometimes, and I think about like the issue of inflation, for instance. Yes, a president can do and take many actions that affect inflation. Yes, the Fed and their decisions affect inflation. But when you hear in the mainstream, and sad to say, mainstream media conveys, well, it's workers' wages going up that create inflation, and the mainstream media does not point to billionaires and CEOs that make obscenely multiple amounts of money. In fact, I was trying to think, is it Mr. Bezos makes in 18 minutes what the average American worker will make in her or his lifetime? This is the thing that we're getting at. I think this is the thing that you're alluding to, that everybody has a role to play in shifting conversation, shifting focus, and ultimately shifting commitment.
Right. So the and inflation is also driven by corporate greed, just inflating.
Yeah, I was clumsily trying to say that.
And so, there's been a history of price controls in the U.S. You know, there's ways to kind of intervene. But I think, you know, the issue as we're going forth in the next 100 days or so is really getting on the ground all over the country and for strategic reasons in the swing states. And, you know, we got, you know, three categories. You've got the so-called Rust Belt states, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, still suffering from post-industrial reorganization. You've got the southern states, up south, North Carolina, and down south, Georgia, and all that history kind of brings. And then the states out in the southwest, Arizona and Nevada, and the demographics there that are quite different than these other states. And so all of those have to be on the ground kind of organizing because it's going to be a tight race no matter what. Harris and the Democrats have a path to 270 in a number of different ways. Even if, you know, Michigan is going to be a challenge because the issue of the Gaza war is very, very live. I was in Michigan over the weekend, and I talked to some folks. Biden won by 150,000 votes. There are 200,000 people in the state who identify as Muslim, 300,000 people in the state who identify as having Middle Eastern background. You've got major universities where students have been active in Ann Arbor and in Lansing and in Detroit. So it's going to be a challenge. The unions are starting to mobilize. We'll see how that goes. But even if Harris loses Michigan, if she wins Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and North Carolina, for example, that's 271 electoral votes, one more than needed. So she can lose four states and still win. But it's going to be tight, kind of no matter how you look at it, with also the possibility of a tie in the Electoral College. If Trump wins Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Georgia, he will have 269 electoral votes. The other 269 will go to Harris. So that's a possibility as well because of this archaic and outdated Electoral College system that we have.
You know, it's kind of a chilling damper when you talk about the machinations of the systems that exist and the systems we're left with. And even before we started our conversation, I've been mindful that there have been some bold women journalists who, again, remind us to work hard and dream big. And you mentioned Michigan, of course, Governor Whitmer.
Right.
Is considered a redoubtable, formidable, and powerful political person. It seems sad that we have to kind of wrestle with the existing system and not dream big. Why not two women on the ticket? You know, why is there a fear? No one says it outrightly, but the conjure of race is certainly at play, both in the tactics of one party and the identity of all who are participating on the whole. How do we get a firm footing to honestly deal with these things, at least with the present political systems we have?
So I think they have to be confronted straight up. The Harris campaign is going to have to articulate a vision for the country that is inclusive, that hasn't been there. And I think there's been, and you know, again, some of this is because of Joe Biden's background. There's been this sense of we have to be almost kind of overly sensitive to working class white men.
Well, you can say it, white grievance,
right.
Basically.
And certainly this is going to be the play coming from Trump and Vance. But I think it's important to be reminded that Biden actually did not do as horrible with white men as people thought. And that there's a long history progressive white male activists, of course, in unions and in other movements. And so that has to be also recognized as opposed to the kind of toxic masculinity that Trump and them are trying to tap into and the misogyny that they're trying to tap into and the racism, as you pointed out, that is just kind of a constant. Trump is very clear that anti-white racism is one of the issues he wants to address. He's talked about it at rallies, not as much so with national media because he knows the poison that represents. But to his base, it is absolutely clear that you know this is a white supremacist program that they're advocating.
And it's a team function because I can't recall him saying DEI categorically, but his surrogates, his supporters, his colleagues, you know, his tragedy happened because they were female Secret Service staffers
and the head of
my opponent
Service.
Can't be possibly qualified. And yet you line up that she's been an attorney general of the state of California, you know, a senator and so on and so forth. And yet, forgive me, but it's the laziness of mainstream media to not interrogate or at least take their interrogate these remarks one or two steps further. I'm sorry.
So I just wanted to point out that Trump especially hates black women. So I mean, he's a misogynist in general. But when you look at his statements against Fannie Willis, against Tish James, against Maxine Waters, you know, you just name the list of prominent black women, and Trump has said the most horrible, wretched thing you could possibly imagine. He cannot contain himself. So we will see as he tries to figure out how to deal with candidate Harris and the gender issue that they have, with his own sort of instinctive, almost feral kind of way in which he really, really kind of loathes black women and has said just some just unspeakable kinds of remarks directly at black women. So all of that needs to be put out there on the record.
So with the 2 minutes remaining, certainly the horrors and pathologies of what you just described, we don't want to leave with. How do we make sense? How do we go beyond the next upcoming convention? What are the things that we should pay attention to? I know it's an open-ended question, but ourselves have to practice our politics.
So I'm going to stand a little bit above the clouds on this one. So two things that did not exist on Saturday were hope and enthusiasm. The Democratic Party, Progressive Movement was dispirited. People would not even watch the news anymore. It had gotten, you know, so bad. I totally get it. And what we've seen in the last 36 hours, 48 hours, are those as dynamics. And that will really kind of drive an opportunity to really defeat MAGA, not just Trump, but MAGA as a whole. So, again, I think, you know, people are way, way more hopeful today than they were, you know, literally just a few days ago.
All right, Dr. Clarence Lussain, thank you for our current look at the political landscape. I want to
thank you, David, as always.
And it's a pleasure. Just keep on doing that work, because I know part of what you do is not merely academic, but it is related to not only your students, but with communities and other people, not only here in Washington, not only across the nation, but around the world.
For sure.
It's about to thank our engineer, Mike Nasella, this morning, the News and Public Affairs Department of WPFW. And he's waving to us through our video connection.
Yeah.
The important thing is, you know, we come here week after week, year after year, because you, the listener, choose to support the station. Throughout every quarter, we do ask you in a specific time period to contribute to the station. We are very mindful that we're trying to do our best, both by music, jazz part, and the justice part, which is also associated with culture, but also with public affairs. And I want to thank listeners for financially supporting the station and making their voices heard to us so we can act accordingly. Coming up next, from this point forth throughout the day, 5 minutes before the hour, is the news. Believe either Sue Goodwin or Chris Bangard Rounds will bring it to you. And every noontime hour, don't forget the blues. Mondays through Fridays, the Wednesday edition is with Clarence the Blues Man Turner. My thanks to him. Again, listeners, thank you. Take good care and peace. Hopefully we'll meet again on the radio.
buckets of blood and our sweat leaves us to our tears.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Christina Onnestad. President Joe Biden delivers an Oval Office address tonight about his decision to bow out of the presidential race. It's his first public speech since testing positive for COVID and since his Sunday announcement. He'll no longer seek re-election. Vice President Kamala Harris campaigns in the Republican state of Indiana today, a day after her first campaign event as a presidential candidate in the swing state of Wisconsin. Christopher Martinez reports.
As Attorney General of California, I took on one of our country's largest for-profit colleges that was scamming students. Donald Trump ran a for-profit college that scammed students.
Vice President Kamala Harris's speech in Milwaukee talked about her priorities, like building up the middle class and stopping what she calls Donald Trump's extreme abortion bans. She also had some choice words about the Republican presidential candidate, and she says she'll put her record up against Trump's any day of the week.
As a prosecutor, I specialized in cases involving sexual abuse. Well, Trump was found liable for committing sexual abuse. As Attorney General of California, I took on the big Wall Street banks and held them accountable for fraud. Donald Trump was just found guilty of fraud on 34 counts.
She sounds like she's spoiling for a fight. For his part, former President Donald Trump says he wants to debate Harris several times. He's also posted an insult on his Truth Social platform, calling Harris dumb as a rock. That phrase has turned viral on social media, but mostly in references to things like Trump's staring at the sun during an eclipse, or his remarks about windmills causing cancer. Reporting for Pacifica Radio, I'm Christopher Martinez.
Donald Trump is holding his first public campaign rally since Biden dropped out of the race. Trump's expected to turn his full focus on Harris in North Carolina today. Protests against Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's address to Congress today continue. Thousands are expected to rally at the nation's capital, demanding an end to the war and for the U.S. to stop arming Israel. Hundreds of Jews were arrested for rallying at the Capitol Rotunda Tuesday, chanting, "No genocide, not in our name." Activists with Code Pink rallied outside the Watergate Hotel where Netanyahu's staying, dressed in jailhouse uniforms and with banners that said, "Arrest Netanyahu." Israeli media have reported the International Criminal Court is expected to issue war crimes arrest warrants for Netanyahu in the coming weeks over the war in Gaza. Activists criticized the barricade set up to keep protesters at bay at the nation's capital. Police from out of state have been brought in for security. Families of hostages in Hamas captivity also rallied at the nation's capital Tuesday, and families of American hostages spoke before Congress urging Netanyahu to reach a hostage release deal with Hamas. Dozens of lawmakers have said they'll boycott Netanyahu's address, including Jewish Independent Senator Bernie Sanders, who spoke on the Senate floor.
Netanyahu is a right-wing extremist and a war criminal who has devoted his career to killing the prospects of a two-state solution and lasting peace in the region. He should not be welcomed to the United States Congress.
Netanyahu's address seeks to bolster U.S. support for continuing Israel's war in Gaza. He's assured a warm welcome from Republican lawmakers who arranged for his appearance. The Biden administration's urging him to focus on closing a deal to end the nine-month-long war. New Jersey Senator Bob Menendez, a Democrat, says he's resigning from office August 20th following a corruption conviction for taking bribes and acting as an agent of the Egyptian government. His letter to New Jersey Governor came a day after the Senate Ethics Committee began a review of Menendez for possible expulsion following his conviction. It gives the governor the ability to appoint someone to the Senate for the remainder of Menendez's term, which expires January 3rd. He faces the possibility of decades in prison. A judge scheduled his sentencing on October.